From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later in the program, pilot Jessica Cox, born without arms. She flies aircraft with her feet. Also, we'll talk about how California schools are doing with State Superintendent Jack O'Connell. And Chubby Checker tells the story behind the song that made him famous. It took the Twist a long time to find an audience, but went on to become a huge hit. But first, how quickly things can change in politics. In 2008, the Democrats were triumphant. They won the White House and built large majorities in Congress. But this year, polls say they could lose both the House and the Senate. Joining us to talk about that and other political stories is David Plouffe, the consultant best known for managing Barack Obama's presidential campaign. He's also author of a book about that campaign, The Audacity to Win. He speaks in Sacramento on Monday. David Plouffe, welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having me, Jeffrey.
Why are the Democrats having such a hard time, apparently, holding on to their majorities in Congress?
Well, first of all, we had great elections in 2006 and 2008, so we won a lot of elections. And when you do that, you've got a lot of, you know, turf to defend. And, you know, we won a lot of seats that traditionally would be Republican. And secondly, when you have a tough economy, and this is the toughest economy since the Great Depression, you know, voters are going to be, you know, very, very unhappy, frustrated, and when you're in charge, you're going to pay a bigger price for that. Now, that being said, I think that we can, over the next 50 days, tighten things up by doing two things. One is making sure voters understand this is a choice. I mean, basically, if you choose the congressional Republicans, these are the same people who brought you the policies that brought us the Great Recession, wouldn't have done the things that have allowed us to slowly dig out of that, and they just want to bring the same policies. They've been very clear about that. When asked what their agenda is going to be, they said, we're going to go back to what we did previously. The country can't afford that because that's why we're in the mess we're in. And secondly, we've got to get Democrats more enthusiastic about voting. And, you know, because right now Republicans are very unenthusiastic. That's not surprising. When you're the party out of power, you tend to have more enthusiasm. But we have to make sure these Democrats out there understand the stakes of the elections, that the Republicans could win, that if they do, they're going to try and roll back the progress we've made on issues like health care. They're going to do government by and for the big health insurers and oil companies, and we can't afford that. So, but listen, we also live in a time now where, you know, elections, you mentioned this in your intro, they swing wildly, particularly independent voters vacillate between the two parties. And I think that what they're looking for is steady leadership, and I think over time, you know, we're going to do very well as a party because we've taken on tough problems. But in the interim here, we're going to have a tough election. There's no question about that.
You said that Democrats are not as enthusiastic as they were in 2008. To what extent is that because Democrats in general in Washington, and including the president, have not done what Democrats around the country thought they would do?
Well, listen, most Democrats, in this, you know, the vast, vast majority of Democrats are very favorable toward what's happened. You know, the passage of health care, you know, economic policies that are geared towards the middle class and small businesses, ending combat operations in Iraq, new investments in energy. So there's great satisfaction in that. We have to convince, and particularly people who pay a lot of attention to politics, there's a lot of people out there who voted in 2008 who, you know, might have voted for the first time, hadn't voted in a while, and, you know, they're not as – part of it is because we won in 08. They don't follow politics as carefully. They may be struggling economically. They may not feel yet that the Republicans are as big a threat as they are. So we have to go out there and talk to voters one-on-one. You know, you're not going to do this through a lot of advertising. That's part of it. You know, maybe some people listening to your show today will say, well, okay, the stakes of the election are big. I'll think about voting. But the best way is to go out and call them on the phone, knock on their door, have a social networking conversation with them. And listen, when we got those voters out in 08, it's not like it just happened. It was really hard work. You know, we spent hundreds of millions of dollars at it. We had millions of volunteers out there trying to convince people to vote. So it's a really hard thing to do. And in your state, you know, Senator Boxer, Jerry Brown, that's what they need to do, and they're trying to do it. You know, you've got to really, really work hard to get these voters out.
My guest is David Plouffe, political strategist who managed Barack Obama's presidential campaign in 2008, also author of a book about that campaign titled The Audacity to Win, and he speaks in Sacramento on Monday night. You said that Democrats are pleased about the passage of the big health care bill, but there are many people to the left of President Obama who are disappointed with the health care bill because it didn't include a single-payer health plan. It didn't even end up including the so-called public option. There are also other issues that progressives are unhappy about, the way prisoners are being dealt with from Guantanamo, and the quote-unquote bailout of the banks. How is the president going to handle the people to his left who are saying, you didn't do what we thought you would do?
Well, first of all, again, you're talking about, in terms of the spectrum of the people who supported the president of the Democratic Party, you're talking about numerically not a huge number. First of all, on health care, I say, you know, his health care plan in the campaign, listen, a lot of candidates, I guess people expect candidates just to say things in their campaign and not mean it. The president is doing everything he said he would try and do in the campaign. His health care plan was not a single-payer health care plan. It just wasn't. And so what I say to people is, I don't know why you got the impression that's what he pursued, but he was pretty clear he was going to pursue something along the lines of what passed. That, first of all, was going to be helpful in the long term in controlling costs. Give a health care coverage to everybody in America, to provide prescription drug relief for seniors, to make sure insurance companies can deny coverage based on people's pre-existing conditions. These are all things that were, I think a lot of people in the country, but certainly Democrats, have been passionate about for decades. So, you know, rather than, you know, what I say is rather than hang our heads about, you know, something we would have preferred in there, let's celebrate the fact that we accomplished something that we've tried to do for decades that's going to have real impact on the country. You know, in terms of the economy, listen, we knew some of the help for the financial sector, for the automotive industry. These were things that were politically very unpopular. But the president thought rather than have the country go over the cliff, rather than have the American automotive industry disappear, that we needed to do some really tough things. And by the way, we should be proud of that, because the way Washington has worked for a long time is that politicians duck tough issues, right? They're too hard. Not before this election. We can't do it now. You know, the president is not built that way. He wants to go in here, and as he said in his inaugural address, the time for childish things is over. So I would tell Democrats, let's kind of review the record here, both in terms of the consistency of what he said he'd do in the campaign and what we've done, and then let's focus on the alternative, because the alternative is a nightmare, from my perspective. So if you want the same crowd that brought us the Great Recession, that probably would have, if their policies had been in place, we would have headed off to a Great Depression. If you want the folks who believe that the health insurance industry and the oil companies ought to be the center of decision making. If, you know, John McCain said he would have been in Iraq for 100 years, Barack Obama brought that war to a close. I mean, there's a big difference here, and that's what we need to focus on.
David Plouffe, political strategist. How would you recommend that the president deal with this rather surprising phenomenon whereby there are a lot of Americans who think he's A, not a native-born American citizen, and B, not a Christian, even though it's well documented that he is both a native-born American citizen, and it's well known that he's been a practicing Christian for many years. It seems to me that he's trying to downplay it, maybe out of a desire to not dignify it. Nevertheless, it keeps floating around, and the numbers of people who don't believe him are rising.
Well, in one poll, they were rising. I mean, listen, we dealt with this in the campaign. There was, you know, a healthy percentage of people. I mean, it was still very small compared to the overall electorate who thought these things. Listen, those people are never, ever, ever going to support Barack Obama or any Democrat for the most part. I mean, but the vast majority of Americans, who are much more thoughtful about it, don't hold those views. I do think that, you know, for people who are not supportive of the president or Democrats, you know, they're more likely to answer in the affirmative on these things. And by the way, I do think that for voters out there who are, you know, non-affiliated voters, swing voters, that kind of approach, you know, believing these things, you know, insisting on talking about them, believing that, you know, the worst, you know, there's socialism and it's all a plot to help the terrorists. I mean, this crazy stuff, that's not where most of Americans live. And you see a lot of agitation in some elements of the Republican Party, and I do think that's something that the middle of the electorate's not terribly comfortable with. And let's be honest, today's Republican Party, you know, for the most part, the real energy, the real intellectual heft, the real power is with the Sarah Palin and Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Becks of the world. And again, that's not where most Americans live. And so, listen, they're going to have a good election on November 2nd. How good, we don't know yet. I think it can be a lot better than people think if we do the right things over the next 50 days. But the long-term future of the Republican Party, because they have not participated in helping the country, they don't have any new ideas, they are completely in the tank with the big corporate special interests. And, you know, they've got this, and it's not a fringe element in the Republican Party. About 30-35% of the Republican Party, you know, believes the things you talked about. And again, that's not where most Americans reside.
But haven't President Obama and Speaker Pelosi had problems rounding up the Democrats in Congress to support the kind of agenda you're talking about? There have been people within the Democratic Party, elected officials, who haven't gone along with what you say Democrats stand for.
Well, although the vast majority of Democrats in the House and Senate, you know, supported the Recovery Act. We actually got some Republican support for that, supported financial reform, which is going to benefit consumers. We got a little Republican support for that. Obviously, we got no Republican support on health care, but the vast majority of Democrats voted for that. So, first of all, let's focus on the vast number of Democrats who've done tough political things, even though they knew there could be, you know, a political cost to them. So rather than focus on, you know, the small number who didn't support, I'd say let's focus on those that did. Then, of course, there's some Democrats. You know, and part of it is when you have big majorities, you have a much more diverse coalition, right? We have Democrats representing every ideological side of our spectrum. The Republicans now, because they have lost so many seats, they're really down to a core of inflexible, rigid ideologues who, even if they happen to have any moderate instincts, don't feel they can act out on it because they'll be vilified. And that's why I tell Democrats, listen, I don't agree with these folks on a lot of issues, but when people like Susan Collins or Olympia Snowe or Lindsey Graham or even Scott Brown from Massachusetts, you know, decide to work with Democrats on some of these issues, you know, they should be applauded for that. Because in today's Republican Party, that's a really hard thing to do because, as you've seen, they get vilified for it.
Many critics, and they include Paul Krugman, the columnist for The New York Times, but many others, said the president spent too much time and energy trying to get Republican support for the health care bill and some other legislation. And as a result, he ended up with little or nothing and wasted time and energy in that. Do you think, with hindsight, that the president should just have tried to push ahead without looking for Republican support?
Well, first of all, little or nothing. I couldn't object more strongly to that. I mean, you know, just historic health reform legislation, financial reform legislation that's going to make a huge difference, so we don't have what happened on Wall Street happen again. Education reform, a recovery act that helps stave off a Great Depression. These are not little things. And secondly, the American people. You know, maybe some people on the far extremes of both parties don't agree with this, but the vast majority of the American people are desperate for their leaders to act like adults and work together. So even if the president doesn't always get their votes, he's going to continue to work with them. But listen, again, if you look at our health care, compare the health reform bill that passed to what we campaigned on. Very, very similar. I mean, I know that there's some people who say, well, it wasn't a single-payer thing. That was never something the president was going to propose. So we should feel proud of that. And as the president, it is very important, and he believes it so passionately. You've got to continue to try and work together. And of course, there's going to be times when you can't or where there's disagreement or the divide is too wide. But we have to do that. This is so important. And again, you know, in some issues, we've had a little Republican support legislatively. In others, it's been a lot. In some, it's been none. But I think that's the right approach. But again, what's important is in the pursuit of working with other, you know, Republicans, is you don't compromise your ideals. And the president hasn't done that. And so, listen, it's pretty easy to be in the peanut gallery. But I think that if you look at what's been done over the last 20 months, under enormously tough circumstances, you know, I think it's something all Democrats, and I would argue all Americans, ought to be proud of.
David Plouffe, he managed Barack Obama's presidential campaign in 2008, and he speaks in Sacramento on Monday night. One other issue I'd like to talk about with you, David. You helped set up Organizing for America, which was a successor organization for the millions of people who supported Barack Obama when he was running for president. But there was an interesting piece yesterday and published on Time.com, written by Jay Newton Small, and he posed the question, what happened to Barack Obama's once vaunted political machine? Neglect is to blame. After Obama was elected, his political aides ignored the army he had created until it eventually disappeared. End of quote. Could you respond to that?
Well, listen, it was an outrageous piece, and I don't say that hardly ever, but, you know, the reporter was given a lot of information about what's really happening. And so, you know, it's unfortunate because there's, in Sacramento today, in California, all across the country, there's thousands of people who have worked to help pass health care, help pass financial reform, help passed the Recovery Act. A lot of them are engaged right now in electoral politics. And, you know, to try and say, well, it's not the same effort as 08, of course, a presidential campaign's a massive undertaking. You're not going to have the same. But we have such intensity, such great volunteers. The fact that we neglected it, we did a huge survey of all of our volunteers after the election and founded OFA based on their feedback. And because we are so reliant on our volunteers out in places like Sacramento, you know, they're helping drive this organization. So I thought it was an unfortunate piece because it was really inaccurate and I think it does not reflect the reality. And listen, there's tens of thousands of people out there working this weekend on the election. We've had over 5 million people. Think about that. 5 million people take some action over the last 20 months. Some of them are volunteering a lot. Some of them have signed petitions. Some of them have attended or press conferences. So there's a lot of activity out there. And it's something that I think is really, really important. And so it's unfortunate. But all I know is I actually, rather than, pontificating about it, have been out there on the ground. I was in California last month and was in Oakland and in L.A. meeting with all of our volunteers, and it's inspiring to be with them. And I'm sure I'll see a lot of them in Sacramento next week. So these people are out there making a difference for their country. They're going to help us do better in these elections than a lot of the pundits think. And, you know, Barack Obama has always believed in the power of average people and normal people to make a difference, and we still do.
David Plouffe's book, The Audacity to Win, is now out in paperback. He speaks at Sacramento's Crest Theater for California Lectures on Monday night. He's best known for running Barack Obama's presidential campaign in 2008. David Plouffe, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, we'll talk about how California schools are doing with State Superintendent Jack O'Connell. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can download our show at capradio.org/insight. Coming up on Talk of the Nation Science Friday, many appliances are Energy Star rated, but how meaningful is that label? It turns out some of those appliances may not save us much energy. That's Science Friday at 11, right after Insight.
Up in the morning and out to school.
It's another installment in our Back to School series. Today we're going to take a broader look at how California schools are doing, especially given the challenges posed by so many layoffs of teachers and other staff. Joining me is the State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Jack O'Connell. Superintendent, welcome back to Inside.
Thank you for having me again, Jeffrey. Always nice to be with you.
Well, you're coming to the end of your eighth and final year as State Superintendent of Public Instruction. How are California schools doing today compared to when you took office?
Our test scores, which is a key indicator for us, not the only indicator, but a key and one of many, are up for 8 years in a row. And Jeffrey, I'm proud to take full credit for that.
Well, of course, the State Superintendent of Public Instruction does not have as much responsibility over public schools in California as the average voter might think. Is that a problem? And if you think it is a problem, how would you change the system in California? Because the governor has his or her own Secretary of Education.
And their roles are not always clearly defined, but there's so much to do. There's plenty of work to do. And I've gotten along very well with, the governor's had the numerous secretaries of education. Quite frankly, a majority of them I've known before their appointment. In fact, I think I can probably say all of them I've known and have had a good relationship, have always had a good relationship with the State Board of Education, another key player. And actually, I do have a considerable authority over our 1,000 school districts. I've set up as a goal for the 4 years ago, I wanted to work on closing the achievement gap. The achievement gap in this state is real, it's stark, it's persistent, and candidly had not been addressed. And I said that I wanted to create a system whereby we would be narrowing the achievement gap. And I'm pleased to tell you that we have narrowed it, not as fast as I would like, and we need to accelerate the closure. But really, for the first time, we're seeing a narrowing, and the trend lines are moving in the right direction. A recent report out from the McKinsey & Company said if we could eliminate the achievement gap in this country, virtually every state budget would be balanced, as well as the national budget would be balanced. And so that has to be a priority. And we've tried to design a system, and that's something I can do, to incentivize our school districts to work on closing the achievement gap. I'll just give you one quick example.
Please.
If folks want to be a California Distinguished School, the Paramount School Recognition Program in our state, I added additional criteria a couple years ago. You need not apply for your recognition unless you are closing the achievement gap.
What could be done that is not yet being done to further close the achievement gap?
Jeffrey, we need to better fund public education. An area of disappointment for me in these 8 years is that we have actually slipped in terms of per capita funding per student when compared across the all of the other 49 states compared to California. We just rank embarrassingly low. We're 47th of all 50 states in terms of dollars per student, and we have not kept up. While we have a resilient school system, educational professionals who are truly motivated for all the right reasons, dedicated, committed, passionate, energetic, making a difference, we could do more. We could do better. We could accelerate the closure of that achievement gap. We could raise the ceiling for all of our students. Now, I'm quite concerned. We have fewer teachers today than we had just a year ago, fewer counselors, fewer librarians, fewer nurses, fewer classes being offered in the arts, music, career technical education. Bus rides are longer for students. I wrote the law for class size reduction with a member of the legislature about 12 years ago. Governor Wilson was great to sign it, I always like to say. We've gotten away from our class size reduction programs. And we know we can quantify the success of these programs. And so that really does pain me. And that's a trend that's going in the opposite and the wrong direction.
Well, it's one thing to say that schools in California are underfunded. It's another thing to get the money to increase the funding. And given the state's chronic and long-running budget problems, a budget gap of about $19 billion in this year, and there isn't even a budget yet, how can we possibly think that there's much of a chance of any significant increase in funding for public schools in California?
We need to make education a priority. We need to provide local communities with the tools necessary to make their funding decisions so that we can fund educational programs to the unique needs of a local community and not be subject to the fiscal limitations of the state, much like we did with school facilities. I helped spearhead the effort. It took over a decade to lower the vote threshold from the very difficult to obtain 67% vote to the 55% vote. And we need to do the same thing so that we can fund our programs. So if schools want to invest more in their teachers, they can. If they want more class size reduction, they can. If they want to be able to hire more counselors, more programs in the arts, more funding for a particular program, they'll have that ability at the local level. And unfortunately, that's been missing. But I'll tell you, the lifeline that we've been thrown has been from the federal government. And the teachers' jobs bill that the federal government, President Obama, Congress, Secretary Arne Duncan helped us pass, that provides $10 billion for the country. We're going to receive $1.2 billion. The governor's office has said that they will sign that bill. In fact, in the absence of the governor, he's in Asia this week. The lieutenant governor's, Abel Maldonado, is going to sign that legislation, I think either today or this weekend. And that will help us. There's also money available the second year of the economic stimulus package, also federal money. And then we have written a grant for what's known as the school improvement grant. It's called SIG grant. And that money will be forthcoming as well within the next couple of weeks. And that will help some of our more challenging schools as well.
Well, all this federal money is coming to California and other states, but for what it's worth, a story in the Sacramento Bee today said that, and I'll quote the beginning of the story, millions of federal dollars meant to add education jobs are expected to reach beleaguered California school districts in the next few weeks, but this isn't likely to add many more teacher jobs in the Sacramento area this year. Instead, local education leaders, wary of years of budget cuts, seem more inclined to sit on the money until they get a look at the state budget. Are you hearing that that's happening, not just in Sacramento, but elsewhere?
Yes, I couldn't argue with that statement, but I do think it will help us. I think you might see additional resource teachers hired. Now, some of this money is going to be one-time money, and so that's the concern. The school improvement grant will be more than that, but that's the concern. But it's designed to be a bridge. It's designed to help us to save jobs, get this economy going again, and be able to retain our professional educators. I wish the money had gotten here a couple of months earlier. But I do think you'll see some folks retained, some resource teachers, perhaps some additional teachers hired on a temporary basis to help us augment our educational efforts in the classroom, even within the existing structure for our class sizes.
Where do you stand on this lawsuit that aims to force California to put more money into public education? You said earlier that you support more money being spent on public schools. However, there is a lawsuit that was brought by several organizations and also some students and parents. They say California's constitution requires everyone to be offered a quality education, and it's not happening because of money. Do you think that this is a matter for the courts to try and force California to spend more on schools?
I do. I'm supportive of these efforts. The California School Boards Association is taking the lead. And it's something that we have talked about and thought about for several years. And whether or not we ultimately prevail, I think it can help us certainly get the attention of this governor, the next governor, and even members of the legislature that will help us increase funding to education.
Wouldn't this just be a variation on the ballot box budgeting that's caused a lot of problems for California?
If California had been properly investing in public education, I believe our economy would be much stronger. I just don't see a scenario where this economy, this hyper-competitive global economy, improves absent additional funding to public education. And whatever rational, reasonable, thoughtful means we can achieve that, I think we have to explore all options.
The Accountability Progress Report comes out next week. It's one of a series of reports about the state of California schools, how students are doing. How can parents make head or tail of all of these reports with all their acronyms coming out?
We've tried to make it so that it's relatively easy to understand. We also do a mailing to every parent that has a student in our public school system that I think is relatively easy to understand, that takes our STAR test, and that's well over 95% of our students in grades 2 through 11. And this will be on our webpage. We can certainly, we walk people through. We walk the media through. And I think the media does a very good job of trying to explain how well our schools are doing. This really merges the state system with the federal system. And we need to merge them so that there's only one system ultimately. But I think we do a pretty good job. And you can break it right down to your school. So you can see if your school is above our statewide goal, which is 800. I have been briefed on the results, and we're going to formally announce them when we have all the data in, and the final data collection date is today, so this will be announced on Monday, I believe. But overall, I'm pleased. Again, we saw more elementary schools, middle schools, and high schools getting above our statewide target, and we'll be releasing that particular data early next week.
Jack O'Connell is California's State Superintendent of Public Instruction. Thank you so much for joining us.
Jeffrey, always nice to be with you, and thank you for the great public service that you perform as well.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Our Back to School series continues through September on Insight and Morning Edition and online at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, pilot Jessica Cox, born without arms. She flies aircraft with her feet. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. I'm on Twitter. You'll find a link at capradio.org/insight. If you ever thought that flying an airplane would be a challenge, even scary, imagine doing it without the use of arms. Well, that's how Jessica Cox flies aircraft. She was born without arms, but that hasn't held her back. She got her license a couple of years ago and flies aircraft using her feet. And this weekend, she's one of the featured pilots at the California Capital Air Show. She joins us. Jessica Cox, welcome to Inside.
Thank you. Good morning.
How did the instructor react when you showed up and said, I want to learn how to fly an airplane?
Actually, he didn't react to me in person because I actually gave him a phone call and I asked him about the possibility of training me. Glenn Davis was my first flight instructor and he had no idea I didn't have any arms. And finally, at the end of the conversation, I told him that I do everything with my feet. And of course, it was kind of hard for him to believe. So I shared with him my website, rightfooted.com, and he went on and he saw everything that I do with my feet and he invited me out to learn in Spruce Creek, Florida.
So. Yeah, and I've seen videos of you doing stuff like texting and playing the piano and even putting your contact lenses in. So I guess that means you can essentially do with your feet what other people do with their hands.
Everything from if I have an itch at the top of my head, I'll reach my right foot up there and scratch the top of my head.
Wow. Did anyone try and persuade you to have a specially equipped aircraft so that... it would be safer, easier, whatever? Because it looks to me like, from the videos I've seen, that you're flying just in a regular cockpit.
That's correct. It's actually a stock airplane. It's the air coupe, though, which does not have rudder pedals. So therefore, the rudders and the ailerons are interconnected. And I have full control with my right foot on the yoke and my left foot on the throttle.
What was it like the first time you took off flying an airplane with your feet?
First time solo, there was nothing. There's no way to really describe. There are no words to describe what that was like. It was the ultimate feeling of independence, empowerment, and freedom. So,
I can imagine. Jessica Cox is a pilot who's flying at this weekend's California Capital Air Show at Mather Airport. She was born without arms and pilots aircraft with her feet. When I watched this video of you piloting, your legs were crossed over quite a lot, and I thought,
yes.
Wow, is that okay? Because what if you had to, is that ever going to be a problem? The fact that your legs are crossed, can you get them out of the way quick enough if you needed to respond to something?
Well, the reason they're crossed is because there's very limited space in the cockpit of the air coupe, and therefore I can't actually have my left foot on the yoke because there isn't enough knee room. So I use my right foot on the yoke and cross over, but I can respond to most anything immediately, and of course, with a lot of practice in that position, I'm able to respond to any kind of situation.
How did you start learning how to do everything with your feet? Was that a natural thing for you, or did someone say, hey, Jessica, you should start using your feet?
It was as natural as a little toddler or a baby learns to use their hands. It was I used to pick up toys with my feet, and that's where my mom would put my dolls at foot side, and I'd reach and grab my dolls with my right foot, or because I'm right footed, so that was very natural as it would be for any child to learn how to use their hands.
Most of us, our feet don't really do very much. We walk on them, we don't see them that much, and they're really not very flexible. But watching your feet, you see your feet a lot because you use them like hands, and they're so flexible, they move in all sorts of directions. What do you think when you see other people's feet that are hidden and not very flexible?
Well, I think that they just haven't tapped into the power of their feet.
Is there anything unusual about your feet?
Well, it's so natural for me right now as I'm talking. I'm actually gesticulating with my feet. That's how my brain is basically wired to my toes, and and it's just so natural for me to. I think it's just so funny if you see me and you see me talking and how I use my feet, and that's how it's kind of unusual in that sense that I'm so used to using them that I'll start gesticulating with my feet.
Yeah, I just looked under the desk, and you got shoes on. Do you often have to take your shoes off, though, to do things in life?
Yes, I wear a lot of slip-on shoes.
Yeah. Your feet, the soles of your feet must be pretty tough, then.
They're pretty tough, yes. I go barefoot as often as I can. So.
Yeah. My guest is Jessica Cox. She's a pilot, and she was born without arms. She does everything, including flying aircraft with her feet. You started doing martial arts when you were 10, and Which martial art did you do? And did you choose one because it was friendlier for someone who doesn't have arms? Because some martial arts make heavy use of hands.
That's true. Taekwondo actually emphasizes a lot of kicks and leg movements. So for me, Taekwondo was a perfect fit. And that's where I started and earned my black belt 4 years later and then rejoined the American Taekwondo in college. And so Taekwondo emphasizes a lot of kicking. And for me, it was just about creating a new curriculum that was solely based on kicks as opposed to hand blocks and punches.
You actually earned two black belts in Taekwondo.
Yes.
Why two? Don't you just sort of become a black belt and that's it?
Well, in the International Taekwondo Federation, that's where I started out in. So then I joined another style called American Taekwondo. And that was where it required me to learn everything else within that style from white belt all the way to black belt, which was a new set of forms and a new set of requirements to be a black belt in that style.
Now, you can fly aircraft. Maybe it was in some ways a bigger step when you learned to drive a car because, you know, when you're flying your aircraft, you're building on your experience of doing something somewhat similar, driving a car. What was it like when you decided to learn to drive? Did you have to overcome any obstacles there?
I think it was more of convincing others that I was just as safe with an unmodified vehicle and without restrictions on my license. And to this day, I have an unrestricted license other than having glasses on there. I can drive any rental car available to me. So it's more of convincing other people than achieving it within my own abilities.
Well, I read that you were at first encouraged to use special modifications in the car. And at first the car was modified and then you removed them. Is that actually what happened?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
Why did you decide to remove them? I mean, presumably the modifications made it easier to drive.
Well, actually, I wanted to be able to have the privilege of walking into any car rental agency and saying I have a reservation for Jessica Cox. And because I have an unrestricted license, that means that I could drive any automatic that's available to me. And if it required that I had modifications on the vehicle, then I'd be limited to a vehicle with those specific modifications and wouldn't have the flexibility of driving any other vehicle that's out there.
Do you know why you were born without arms?
No, it's actually a mystery to this day. It's a rare congenital situation, and my mom, my dad, they have no idea, and the doctors didn't have any idea at all. So to this day, there is no real answer to that.
Do you know other people who have the same condition?
I do. Yes, I do.
And what kind of lives do they lead? Are you an inspiration to them, or are you just like them? I mean, are they doing crazy things too?
There are some that are doing crazy things in their own world. And for me, it's also about inspiring the younger ones who might see the limitations of not having arms, but to be able to share with them and anyone in general what they can achieve. It's rewarding, yes.
What are you going to be doing at the California Capital Air Show?
Well, I have Kim Blackseth's Aircoupe 415D, actually, yeah, 415C model out there, and I will be around there showing everyone how it is that I manipulate the controls on this Aircoupe, and I'll be sitting in the cockpit showing everyone, and I'd love to chat with anyone who comes to visit.
And you live in Arizona?
Yes.
So you flew up here?
Yes, I did. I actually flew up commercially, but...
By the way, if you want to see video of Jessica flying and doing other things, there are links to her on YouTube and her website at our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Jessica Cox, she's a pilot flying at this weekend's California Capital Air Show at Mather Airport. She was born without arms, pilots aircraft with her feet, along with anything else she chooses to do in life. Jessica, it was great to meet you. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, Chubby Checker tells the story behind the song and the dance that made him famous. You're You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Email us. We're at insight@capradio.org. Later today on Capital Public Radio News, how a Sacramento neighborhood is reacting to a nearby mosque's plan to expand into a second building, and what Sacramento police are doing to try and reduce disturbances during and after this weekend's Second Saturday. It's one of the world's most famous songs, and it first became a hit 50 years ago this summer. The Twist wasn't an overnight success, but it's done pretty well. You still hear it on the radio and at weddings and the like. And this weekend, you can hear The Twist sung by the man who made it famous, Chubby Checker. He's coming to Grass Valley. I spoke with him the other day and asked what he thought when he finished recording The Twist. Did it sound like a big hit?
We didn't know what was going to happen. We didn't know that the song was going to change everything. We didn't know that. I was always surprised when I realized that we had this big hit song that was not like anything else in the world. So it's always been something, you know, very special for me.
Where did the dance come from?
The kids in the neighborhood made up a dance to a song called The Twist by Hank Ballard, and radio stopped playing it, and no one was going to hear the song. And no one was going to see the dance, and we had an opportunity, a window there, and we came in and campaigned and worked very hard on that song. For months we worked on it until a disc jockey in Pittsburgh named Porky Chadwick decided to play the record as the number one side, and then things started to happen immediately.
You said they're playing it as a number one side or the A side. I read that the head of your record company didn't think it was an A side. What did he not like about it?
He's not around anymore, but I don't think he even knew what he was talking about. I think that it was, look, The Twist is a gift from God. It has done so many things for so many people. When people come to Grass Valley to see Chubby Checker, they're not coming to see Chubby Checker. They're coming to see history. And when I say that, I mean they're coming to see the number one song on the planet. In 2008, The Twist was named the number one song on the planet. They're also coming to see the only song to be number one twice since God put man on the planet, which is The Twist. They're coming to see the first platinum that was ever given, Let's Twist Again. They're coming to see the first rock and roll song that received a Grammy, that was Let's Twist Again. They're coming to see dancing change, the song that changed dancing in the world 24/7. They're coming to see the only singer that has 5 albums in the top 12 at the same time, 9 double-sided hits. They're coming to see history. And Grass Valley, if you're not coming to see Chubby Checker, something's not right with you.
That's an amazing list of achievements.
They're coming to see all that. So I don't want them to think they're coming to see some washed-out old guy that's been around for 50 years. And they're going to come see, if you're coming to see someone all washed up and beaten up and out of shape, stay home. But if you're coming out to have some fun, you need to come out and see it.
That's your phone, isn't it?
We got rid of it.
Do you still do the dance?
What do you think? I'm all beaten up or something? Listen, what you're coming to see is a 1960 Corvette with a 427 engine in it that still runs as fast as all the other cars. That's what you're coming to see. If you're coming to expect something that's all worn out and washed out, stay home. But Chubby Checker is coming to Grass Valley, and I hear, this is a rumor, I hear that we are not quite where we want to be on ticket sales. I am not coming to Grass Valley to play for a half house. I'm coming to Grass Valley to play for a full house of people, and once you see this show, you're never going to be the same.
Chubby Checker, you listed a lot of your achievements, but you didn't mention my favorite song of yours, and that's Limbo Rock. Where do you think Limbo Rock fits in your career?
We didn't know that dumb song was going to be a hit. we didn't know that this instrumental that was recorded by the Champs, it was an instrumental called Limbo Rock, and we had no idea. We put some lyrics to that song and went in the studio and had a fun afternoon. And the next month when we put that song out, everybody was playing it. We just didn't know. It's a fun song, and it's always played. All the weddings play it, and all of the bar mitzvahs, the twist, and Limbo is the number one song at all the weddings and bar mitzvahs because the generations can all come together and be associated with each other.
I read that your first record was actually a novelty song in which you did impressions. Was that where you saw your showbiz career, sort of as an entertainer more than a singer?
We don't want to talk about that one. I mean, it was the first record I ever made was a big hit. It went 35 on the charts. But you know something? I thought that I was just too cool to sing that song. I was doing impressions. And it was one of those novelty songs. And I had to be a clown in front of all these people, and I later learned to love the class, but I really didn't like it when I made that song. But I do realize that that song was called Mary Had a Little Lamb. I think it has a God presence in that song.
Are you still pretty good at doing impressions?
I'll be doing some when I come to Grass Valley. I'll be doing some things on stage, and the audience really has a good time with it. When people come to see Chubby Checker, they will be a part of what I'm doing. When people come to shows, they normally just sit and clap, and they clap, and they clap, and they go home. When they come to see Chubby Checker, they'll be seeing something much different. The centerpiece of the show are the people. I'm just a good excuse for the party. So if the party doesn't germinate, I'm going to be in lots of trouble. I want to see lots of people at my show. And I think the only reason that I'm hearing this rumor that we're not sold out is because of airplay.
Really?
And I want people to know that the only thing that I'm suffering is airplay. We have award-winning music. Our music, all of our music is historical. Everything that we have done, our presence in the music industry is historical. Everybody's doing the twist. Dunkin' Donuts is doing the twist. Tropicana's doing the twist. Everybody's twisting. And nobody associates that with Chubby Checker. I want people to know. The only reason that we're having any trouble with anything with our shows and people coming to our show is because of airplay. The only difference between Rod Stewart and me is that he gets more airplay than I do. But I can tell you something, folks. You come to see Chubby Checker, and I'll be very embarrassed if my house is not filled in Grass Valley. I'll tell you that right now. But I'll tell you something also. The best show in the business is happening in Grass Valley. I do it better than most people, and I've been doing it longer than most people, and I'm good at what I do.
You've been doing it long.
All about you.
You've been doing it longer than Rod Stewart.
Not too much long, about 6 years. Just about. And remember, anybody that's in the music industry, that's singing rock and roll music, are all old people. All of them.
Yeah.
They're 60 years old and over, all of them. Bruce Springsteen, all of them. Elton John, they're all old people. And I think that I kick more butt than most of the old rockers. I do it well. Come out and check it out.
I bet you do. You're famous as Chubby Checker, but your real name is Ernest Evans. Do people, your family and friends, do they call you Ernest or Ernie or Chubby?
when someone calls me Ernest, I always become afraid. I say, uh-oh. Someone, hey, Ernest. I say, uh-oh, who is that?
The police.
And usually when someone's calling me Ernest, or I see something on the mail, I say, oh, it must be the Internal Revenue Service. Because they know him very well. But other than that, you know, Ernie's a good guy, and Ernie's on the phone talking to you right now about Chubby Checker. Because Ernie always talks about Chubby Checker, because when we get together on stage, we always have a great time.
Yes.
You were, you're from the South, but you were raised in Philly. Why did your family move?
Well, you know, my dad and mom had an argument in South Carolina down in Spring Gully. They had an argument, and she decided to leave South Carolina and come to Philadelphia. And I was just a young kid. And my dad sold the farm and all the chickens and the cows and the pigs, and he came up to Philadelphia, and that's how the family got back together, and that's how I got to Philly. If it wasn't for that argument, I wouldn't be on the phone talking to you.
Really? Well, you could have been a country singer.
Well, you know something? I'm going to do a little bit of that in Grass Valley. And all of you, if anybody wants to know about the countryside of Chubby Checker, go to iTunes and Amazon.com and pick up an album. It's called The Texas Twist. Got to pick that up.
Is there any kind of twist you haven't done?
It's just called that. You know, the reason why I call it The Texas Twist, because I wanted to want people to know about Chubby Checker's countryside. And all those songs in there are all originals. So if anybody wants to see my countryside, then go to Amazon.com, iTunes and Amazon.com, and pick up The Texas Twist. I'm sure you'd be pleasantly surprised that Chubby knows how to twang. I twang real good.
I can believe it. Chubby Checker, he's at Grass Valley this weekend, the Veterans Memorial Auditorium, Saturday evening at 8. Chubby Checker, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, and thank you so much. And folks, I'll tell you something. The first time I came to California, I fell in love. And every time I'm trying to say that there's a little California that's always on my body. And thank you, and I'm glad to be coming and seeing you guys. And I'm going to give you a good time.
I'm sure you will. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Bye-bye.
God bless.
Wow, that's Chubby Checker. Insight's theme was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Today's associate producers, Lynn Weaver, Esteban Hernandez, Susan Morar, and Natalie Rothfels. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The senior producer, Jen Picard. The executive producer, Joe Barr. We'll be back on Monday. Thanks for listening to Insight.